Remembering Paul Butterfield and his blues band Double Trouble right here on Undercurrents. Ah, that's so good. Michael Fronte and Spearhead from his latest Follow Your Heart, Brighter Day. And it was...
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial.
K282BH Philomer on 104.3 FM.
And K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
And streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Volunteer-powered community radio.
KBOO.
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 Coming this Monday at 2 p.m., the Monday Sampler presents part two of Ian Fleming's Goldfinger.
Tell me, were you off the Goldfinger?
I was going to kill him.
What did he do to you?
He killed my sister. You knew her. Jill Masterton.
I'm sorry. More blood on my hands.
Toby Stevens stars as Lieutenant Commander James Bond and Sir Ian McKellen as Elric Goldfinger.
So, Mr. Bond, who are you? Who sent you here?
Goldfinger, the girl and I will work for you. We are capable people. You could put us to good use.
Good use and get two knives in my back. No, Mr. Bond, I prefer you to die.
So tune in this Monday, September 15th at 2 p.m. as the Monday Sampler presents Ian Fleming's Goldfinger. Right here on Community Radio, KBOO Portland.
Hello and welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal and cultural transformation. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. We live in a time of melting Arctic ice, soaring temperatures, extreme weather events, and bee colony collapse. A time desperately in need of leadership and action if we wish to avoid an apocalyptic future. Solutions can come at a local level or from the much larger fight against the fossil fuel industry, and hopefully both. But both sides of the global climate fight, from the center of the maelstrom and from the growing hive of small-scale answers, require a renewed commitment and a new approach to the fight to build and preserve a sustainable planet. Our guest on Pathways today is Bill McKibben, author of the book Oil and Honey, The Education of an Unlikely Activist. Bill is also the author of The End of Nature, Deep Economy, Earth, and numerous other books. He is the founder of the environmental organizations Step It Up and 350.org and was among the first to warn of the dangers of global warming. He is the Schumann Distinguished Scholar at Middlebury College, a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and the 2013 winner of the Gandhi Prize. Hello, Bill, and welcome to the Pathways program.
So good to be with you.
Well, your book, Oil and Honey, is a kind of memoir, a memoir of an activist. How did you end up transforming from a writer into a global activist?
Well, I wrote the first book about climate change back when I was a young man in my late 20s, a book called The End of Nature. That was a quarter century ago. I think at the time I assumed my job was to write about it, and that a working, rational political system would take the data that was coming in the scientists who were showing up every year on Capitol Hill saying the worst thing that had ever happened to the planet was in the process of happening, and that the political system would do something about it. About 20 years into that, it became clear to me that we were instead seeing a two-decade-long bipartisan effort to accomplish nothing, and it was entirely successful, and that what we needed to shake it out of that was a movement. You know, we can't ever outspend the fossil fuel industry. It's the richest enterprise humans have ever engaged in. Exxon, each of the last 4 years, has made more money than any company in the history of money. Instead, if we're going to stand up to them, we need the currencies of movements, passion, spirit, creativity. Sometimes we need to spend our bodies, you know. And so that's why we began building these movements, and it's been exciting to watch it spread.
And why are you referred to as an unlikely activist?
Well, because I'm a writer by trade. I don't, I mean, writers, if you think about it, are introverts. Probably if we were good at communicating in other ways, we might not have become writers anyway. And I'd really rather spend my time at home in my study writing than out on the road. But on the road's where I've been most of the last 5 years. 350.org works in every country on Earth except North Korea. We've coordinated about 20,000 rallies, spearheaded the fight against this Keystone pipeline. Now we're running a huge global campaign for divestment of people to divest their fossil fuel stocks, sell them, and try and do some damage to the industry that's doing so much damage to the planet.
I want to hear about that divestment plan a little later, but you mentioned that we've had for the last 20 years a bipartisan effort to accomplish nothing. Are the Democrats as bad as the Republicans?
No, they're not. I think one way to say it is that the fossil fuel industry has bought one of our two political parties and terrified the other one. There are Democrats who do the right thing from time to time. At the moment, there are no Republicans in Washington who are willing to, barely any who are even willing to acknowledge the existence of climate change, and none who are willing to do anything about it. It's a sad state of affairs. Sad state of affairs all around. One saved from being a complete cynic by some of the exceptions to this rule. I live in Vermont, so I get to watch my noble Senator Bernie Sanders up close, and reminds me that even in politics, there are some people who are in the game for the right reasons.
So do you think that this speaks to political corruption, or is it deeper than that, that we live in this, like, you know, diluted infosphere?
Well, there's certainly some of that. But I think that the failure to do the obvious simple things like put a price on carbon that would reflect the damage it does in the atmosphere is pretty much straight on a reflection of the power of the fossil fuel industry.
But we don't put a tax on corn.
Fossil fuel industry is the only industry on Earth that's allowed to put out its waste for free. Nobody else. I mean, if you own a restaurant here in Portland, you can't at the end of the night just go shovel all your garbage out in the middle of the street, even though that would be the cheapest thing to do. Civilization has said now for some time, this is a poor idea. It will attract rats and we'll have leptospirosis. So you have to pay to put it away, and that's going to cut into your profits and whatever. Fossil fuel industry is the only industry that isn't like that. It gets to pour CO2 into the atmosphere for free, and that's why it's so difficult for sun and wind and other things to compete at the speed that we need them to be competing.
When did you first become aware of global warming?
In the late 1980s, I was living in the wilderness in New York State. I'd left up the Adirondack Mountains, the best, biggest wilderness in the East. I'd left my job at the New Yorker magazine, where I wrote Talk of the Town when I was first out of college, and moved to the woods, and was very much in love with the woods and the wilderness. And I was reading the first papers, scholarly papers about climate change, and beginning to understand that this woods where I lived, whose wildness was so valuable to me, was not as wild a place anymore as we thought that its temperature was changing and hence its flora and its fauna, even though there were very few people there. The habits of our species were causing dramatic shifts. And so that first book was...
Is that what inspired your first book?
It was. It was half reporting and half sort of philosophical essay, and the dominant mood was sadness. Not fear, but sadness at the loss of this wild world. Since then, I've, of course, spent a lot of time around the rest of the world and encountered lots of people, most of them very poor, who are dying, literally, from the effects of climate change. So now perhaps I have some better reasons for devoting as much of my life as I do to this cause.
And you have written that global warming is the biggest problem humanity has ever faced. Why is this?
Well, it's literally the biggest thing we've ever done, and by a large margin. You know, so far we've already burned enough coal and gas and oil and put enough carbon in the atmosphere to raise the Earth's temperature about a degree Celsius. That's been enough to melt the Arctic. It's been enough to take every ocean on Earth and make it about 30% more acidic than it was before. It's been enough, since warm air holds more water vapor than cold, to make the atmosphere about 5% wetter and turn load the dice for devastating drought and devastating flood, both of which we see now on a just daily basis. So already, with 1 degree of temperature increase, we've left behind the Holocene. And the most important thing that happened in your lifetime or mine was that we left behind this 10,000-year period of benign climatic stability that scientists call the Holocene. It's the only period that we know of about human beings. All recorded human history comes in that 10,000 years, and now we're out of that period. The only question is how far out of it we're going to go. As I say, we've raised the temperature 1 degree so far, but on our current trajectories, we're aiming for 4 or 5 degrees this century, which probably isn't workable as a civilization.
Now, how has your perspective changed in the last 25 years since you wrote The End of Nature, considering that the warnings in that book have gone largely unheeded?
Well,
I mean, is it just that much worse and that much more depressing?
Yeah, but, you know, I've become more responsible and gotten more involved in the fight. And so I've enjoyed watching people begin to respond in large numbers. You know, we had the first big climate rally in U.S. history this February in D.C., and there were 50,000 people out on the mall, and it was a very good sign that the fight was finally underway. We've seen the largest civil disobedience action about anything in 30 years in this country to protest the Keystone Pipeline. Many, 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 many of us gone to jail. And so the movement's starting to rise, and that's a good thing.
Now, in your book, Earth, which you wrote sometime back, you argue that our hope depends on scaling back, on building the kinds of societies that can hunker down, concentrate on essentials, create the type of community that will allow us to weather trouble on an unprecedented scale. But one question that always occurs to me is, how do we scale back without some kind of massive human die-off?
The best answer to that probably is the one that economists have been giving for a long time. If we put a serious price on carbon, then we would see all the mechanisms of our market system go to work to take that information and cause us to reduce our use of fossil fuel and promote the other alternative energies that might still be able to allow us to live much of the life, if not all of it, that we've been leading, but in a much less damaging way. So that's the hope. It's what every economist, left, right, center, has recommended for years. The reason we can't do it is because of the political power of the fossil fuel industry. That's why we try to weaken them with things like divestment.
Uh-huh. So the problem is political and the solution is political.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then there's some hope in that. I mean, what's it going to take before enough people realize that even if we discover, I love these things where we've just discovered another Saudi Arabia worth of energy in North Dakota, you know, and I'm thinking,
that's bad
who
news.
Cares? No, you know, I mean, you can't burn it.
Actively bad news. yep. Well, look, as I say, if the economics of carbon were different, if it carried that price, then no one would be bothering to look for tar sands oil or to drill miles beneath the ocean. People would be leveraging their money to go do sun and wind.
Now, I want to get this question out of the way because it always comes up. Is there a difference between climate change and global warming, or is it just semantics?
It's just semantics. In fact, I've been at this so long that when I started, we called it the greenhouse effect.
Right. And that's a good thing to call it, right?
Same thing.
Right. So what is the significance of the number 350? You started 350.org.
350 is probably the most important number in the world, but no one knew it till 5 years ago when Jim Hansen at NASA and his team published a paper in which they said, we now know enough about carbon to know how much is too much. Any value greater than 350 parts per million is not compatible with the planet on which civilization developed and to which life on Earth is adapted. Now, that's strong language for scientists to use. It's stronger still if you know that anywhere you are today, outside in Portland, in Prague, in you name it, it's 400 parts per million already and rising.
Even in the rain.
Parts per million per year. No matter what's going on, carbon stays in the atmosphere about 100 years, the molecule. So it's we're rising 2 parts per million per year. We're way too high already, and we're headed much higher at the moment.
We're already over 400, right?
Exactly.
And so what is that? What are the ramifications of that? Is it hopeless? I mean,
no.
Scale back? Is there?
Look, it's hopeless to stop global warming from happening. We've waited too long to do that. The planet's already warmed a degree, and we're going to come very close to 2 degrees, even if we do everything right at this point. But it's still possible, we hope, to keep it from going up 3 or 4 or 5 degrees. It's going to be a difficult century. The question is whether we can keep it from being a completely impossible one. And that's an open question, and it depends largely on how quickly and forcefully we act going forward.
What about technologies like carbon sequestration? Is there any...
They seem to...
To them?
They're technically doable. You can take carbon and put it underground, but at the moment, anyway, it's way too expensive to be of any real value. I mean, if you think about it, it's a difficult technical problem. When you burn, say, coal, the carbon atom combines with 2 oxygen atoms from the atmosphere to make CO2. So if you brought in a train car load of coal, you have to take 2.5 train car loads full of CO2 back out someplace and pump it underground. That's very expensive. By the time you've paid for that, it's much cheaper to make electricity with windmills.
And what about carbon recapture?
Same deal. It's very, very expensive to do.
Maybe we'll invent some ray gun or something.
Well, I think we've invented the technologies we need. They're called solar panel, you know.
Right.
That's where we got to go.
Right. Oh, yeah, obviously. I was just wondering if there's some way we could get from 400 down to 350.
Well, we can. Happily, as they have since time immemorial, oceans and forests and things sequester carbon.
Right.
They do it fairly slowly. And our problem is that we have to stop. I mean, it's like a drain on a bathtub. It's still draining. Every tree every day is taking in a little carbon. But if you're pouring water in the top faster than it's draining out the bottom, the tub's still going to overflow.
Right. And what kind of impact has the organization 350.org had so far?
I'd say it's been largely, for at least for the first few years, was largely educational. We've done what CNN called the most widespread days of political action in the planet's history. We've done about 20,000 rallies in almost every country, not North Korea, but every place else. That's been good. It's helped educate people about where we are. Now we're engaged in more direct confrontational politics. this Keystone Pipeline fight has kept the pipeline from being built for the last 2 years, and that's kept about 900,000 barrels of oil, barrels of the dirtiest oil on Earth, a day in the ground. So that's useful. And now this divestment fight is a powerful, important fight to be engaged in. So far, about 15 big cities have sold their fossil fuel stocks, including Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, Providence. A number of colleges have done likewise, and we're beginning to see action by religious denominations. Our oldest Protestant denomination, the United Church of Christ, which dates its roots back to the arrival of the Pilgrims, voted this summer to divest. They, in essence, said it really makes no sense to pay your pastor by investing in companies that are running Genesis backward, you know.
So how does this, what does this mean? This just means if you have stock in an oil company, you get rid of it?
Well, yeah, but and that's fine. And if you go to gofossilfree.org, you can get some instructions about how to do it for yourself. But what we really want is big institutions to sever their ties, because the point is less to bankrupt Exxon than it is to politically bankrupt them, to make it impossible for them to keep exerting that level of control on our Congress and on many other capitals around the world. That's why if you're an alumna or alumni of a college, go and make sure that you're not donating money unless, I just won a prize of $50,000, which I'm donating to Middlebury College, where I teach, because it's a wonderful school. But I'm sending it with a note saying, keep this in escrow until you divest from fossil fuel.
Oh.
And I hope, we think a lot of people will do likewise around the...
Oh. And so they are invested in fossil fuel.
They are.
Their endowment.
Part of their endowment.
Right. Oh. And so have they moved on that?
They haven't yet.
Uh-huh. How long ago was that?
Well, we just started work on all of this about 9 months ago.
I see.
The fight is young. The precedent was set during the apartheid era in South Africa when 155 colleges and many, many cities, towns, state governments divested their holdings in companies doing business with the racist regime there. And it eventually was successful. When Nelson Mandela got out of prison, one of the first places he came was the U.S., and instead of going first to the White House, he went first to the University of California to thank students there for forcing the divestment of about $3 billion worth of stock. And he said, we fought to liberate ourselves, but we also needed help from the rest of the world. Now, Mandela's longtime collaborator, Desmond Tutu, the Nobel Peace Laureate, sort of launched this drive for fossil fuel divestment. He said, if you could see what's happening to Africa with drought and famine, you'd understand why we're asking you to take up this tool again.
Mm-hmm. So would you recommend to people, it seems to me like one way that people could be activistic in their individuals, is to do what you did, is to, even if it was just $100 and they donate it to the endowment with that cap?
I think it's a very good idea. I think the point is we need to make trustees of institutions and things aware that this is a rogue industry that we don't want to be connected with. It's really like tobacco. If you are unwilling to keep your money in tobacco stocks, and most of the country's colleges and universities say have made that decision, then you should be equally uncomfortable producing secondhand smoke that contains carbon.
In fact, you've referred to oil companies as the tobacco industry of our day.
Yeah.
That's what you're talking about.
They're, I think, a morally, at this point, illegitimate business. They provided a useful product. And for the moment, of course, all of us have no choice but to use a little bit of that every day, hopefully as little as possible. But we have a choice as to whether or not to profit from it, and a choice as to whether or not to help them continue to keep real action from happening in our nation's capital. If you're invested in a company like Chevron, it meant you were party to the largest campaign donation post Citizens United before the last election, 2 weeks before, designed to make sure that the House of Representatives stayed in the hands of climate deniers. It was successful. Nothing will happen about climate change in Washington in the next few years.
What else can we do other than writing endowments, and what else can we do on an individual level to stop or slow global warming?
You know, if we had 100 years, the answer to that question would be the kind of slow, graceful cultural evolution that humans are best at. I put in a good light bulb and you come over for dinner and see it, and you put in a solar panel and your brother-in-law sees it and buys a Prius, and on we go. That stuff's good. If we had 100 years, it would be sufficient. We don't have anything like that. Physics allows us a much shorter window. And so in that short run, really the most important thing that individuals can do by far is join together with other individuals into a real organized political force. That's why we set up things like 350.org, to allow us to join our voices into a common demand for action. And it's beginning to work. You know, don't do it lightly. So, you know, you may, if you get caught up in it, find yourself someday, as I did, in a jail cell someplace.
Do you think it's possible that things could get so bad before the powers that be wake up to the fact that we have to stop burning fossil fuels, but that things could get so bad so that it is hopeless?
Yes.
Too late?
Yes, there definitely are scientific scenarios that are not far-fetched, that are very, very hard to deal with. The most obvious comes if you heat the planet enough, you begin to get uncontrolled methane releases from beneath the ocean and beneath the tundra. Methane, CH4, is a potent greenhouse gas, and if it's escaping uncontrolled into the atmosphere in quantity, there would be nothing we can do about it. We still have our hand on the carbon thermostat, but we won't have our hand on the methane thermostat. We better do what we can to stop heating the planet before that mechanism gets fully activated.
How do you feel that President Obama has stood up for the environmental movement?
I think President Obama's real test will come with his decision sometime in the next year on the Keystone Pipeline. If he does the right thing and blocks it, it'll be the first time any world leader has said, no, here's a big project we're not going to build because of its effect on the environment. That would give him a climate legacy. It would also be an opening wedge in getting the international conversation that died at Copenhagen in 2009 back underway. If he fails on Keystone, I think we'll say, as we've said, I'm afraid, with a few other things, very nice talk, very little action.
In 2013, this year, you won the Gandhi Prize.
Mm.
What is that about, and how has it affected you?
The Gandhi Prize, you know, I mean, just to think about, if you think about the 20th century, I think the great invention of the 20th century wasn't nuclear power. It was nonviolence as a form of political persuasion. And we hardly have investigated how this works, but we think it seems to be an incredibly powerful way to change people's minds and hearts and actions. So I'm very, very honored to be a very, very small part of a very long and rich legacy that I hope gets much longer and richer.
Tell us, we've only got about a minute left, so please tell us about your website and what people can find or do there.
Well, 350.org is the name of the organization and the URL for the website. And what you can do when you go there now is get all the information you need to join in these various campaigns. It's a new kind of campaigning, really. It's sort of open source, you might say, or a kind of potluck supper. We work on a huge scale around the world, but there's only 25 or 30 people who actually work for 350.org. So it's basically run by volunteers in places all over the world. It's more like a potluck supper. We set the kind of date and the theme, and people come up with incredibly creative ways to express this common global desire for a future that works.
So in closing, what a message would you like to leave with our audience today?
Organize, organize, organize. We're up against the biggest problem we've ever faced. And the answer to it lies in our ability to come together. As individuals, we're essentially powerless against climate change. As a energized species, we have at least a decent shot.
Well, thank you very much for being with us, Bill. Keep up the good work, and thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
But once again, we have run out of time. And for those who tuned in late today, this is Paul O'Brien, and you can replay this entire interview anytime you want via the internet. Today, we've been visiting with Bill McKibben, author of the book Oil and Honey, The Education of an Unlikely Activist. To our listeners, I want to say thank you for tuning in to Pathways, which you can listen to and forward to others at divination.com.fm. This is your host, Paul O'Brien, reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways and its podcasts, the interview program dedicated to personal and cultural transformation. Thanks again for tuning in and being a part of it.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communication Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO